for 11 o'clock. We're about a half hour away from Words and Pictures today, as always, featuring conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. That's at 11:30. But first, stick around for Between the Covers. Your host, David Naiman, will be talking to author Celeste Eng about her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere. That is coming right up here on The Boo. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Veg Fest, October 14th and 15th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Portland Veg Fest celebrates plant-based living with special guest speaker, running legend Scott Urich, along with free food samples, health and nutrition speakers, chef demonstrations, fitness stage workouts, restaurants, films, and activities for kids and teens. Again, that's the Portland Veg Fest, Saturday, October 14th and Sunday, October 15th, at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO members and support from True West, presenting David Rawlings at the Roseland Theater in Portland on March 9th. David Rawlings will tour with his album Poor David's Almanac, recorded with musical partner Jillian Welch. Tickets at roselandpdx.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer Celeste Eng. Celeste Eng earned her degree in English at Harvard University and her MFA in creative writing from the University of Michigan. Her first novel, Everything I Never Told You, was a New York Times bestseller, the winner of the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature, the Massachusetts Book Award, the Amazon Book of the Year, and a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Her fiction and essays have appeared widely, including One Story, The Guardian, TriQuarterly, and the New York Times. She's also the recipient of a Pushcart Prize and a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. Celeste Eng is here today to talk about her second much-anticipated novel, Little Fires Everywhere, a book that has received the coveted starred review from Kirkus, Booklist, Library Journal, and Publishers Weekly. Peter Hodavies says of Little Fires Everywhere that it is a dazzling protean work, a comedy of manners that doubles as a social novel and reads like a thriller. By turns wry, heartrending, and gimlet-eyed, it confirms Celeste Eng's genius for gripping literary fiction. Jody Picoult adds, with brilliance and beauty, Celeste Eng dissects a microcosm of American society just when we need to see it beneath the microscope. How do questions of race stack up against the comfort of privilege, and what role does that play in parenting? Is motherhood a bond forged by blood or by love? And perhaps most important, do the faults of our past determine what we deserve in the future? Be ready to be wowed by Eng's writing and unsettled by the mirror held up to one's own beliefs. Welcome to Between the Covers, Celeste
Eng. Thank you so much for having me.
In preparing for this interview in particular, I couldn't think of any other person other than one other interview that I've done that so uses place as character. And I just wanted to mention this conversation I had with Jonathan Lethem. I don't know if you read Dissident Gardens, but it takes place in Queens in the 1930s. But it doesn't just take place in Queens. It takes place in a place called Sunnyside Gardens, which is one of the first planned communities in the United States that arose around the Garden City movement. And because he's looking at a Jewish communist family in the 1930s, and these gardens are properties where people have shared communal spaces, and they're all being taxed towards the upkeep of these common spaces, you feel this conversation going on between his characters and the actual way in which their neighborhood is organized and planned. So I was hoping we could start with Shaker Heights as a character, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the history of Shaker Heights, some of the rules, and some of the sort of tone that we enter, that is the tone of the space rather than of the people in the space.
Sure. So this novel really grew out of my wanting to write about Shaker Heights, which is my hometown. It's where I lived from about age 10 until I went away to college, and is a place that I really loved and I still love. And it was after I'd been away from home for about a decade that I kind of realized how unusual Shaker Heights was. You know, I had just enough distance to kind of look back on it with a little bit more clarity than I could have when I was living there. Shaker Heights was one of the first planned communities in the United States. It was incorporated in 1912 by these two brothers called the Van Swearingen brothers. And their idea was that they were going to purchase this tract of land right outside of the east side of Cleveland that had previously been owned by a group called the North Union Shakers, the religious utopian society. And they thought, we're going to build this perfect community. So that people who don't want to live in Cleveland anymore can move out here to the country, as they thought of it at the time, and we're going to build this sort of perfect little world. And Shaker Heights, really from its beginning, has had everything sort of planned out with that kind of goal, from what color the houses on the street could be. They didn't want everything to look the same, but they wanted to make sure nothing would clash, no colors clashing. So there would be these prescriptions about what colors you could use depending on what style house you had. They had a lot of regulations about how the streets could be laid out, you know, thinking about, we're going to slow traffic down here, we're going to set the school here so that children don't have to cross any major roads to get to school. They can all walk. That kind of level of planning really has been part of the community since the very beginning.
Hmm. And even there was how often you mow your lawn or what you do with your trash.
Exactly. So a few of these are anecdotes in the book. The community really wants, they're very concerned with curb appeal and with the appearance of the community being tidy and orderly and well kept. And so if you don't mow your lawn, if you go away on vacation, for example, and you don't have anyone come to mow it for you, the city will come and mow it for you if it gets too long, and then they'll send you a bill for the yard work that they've done for you. And similarly, on garbage day, you can't put your garbage at the front of the house on the curb because that will make the street look messy, and they don't want that, even for a very short period of time. So the garbage cans have to stay at the back of the house, which is also where the garage doors have to be because they don't want garage doors on the front of the house. Those are unsightly too. And the community has a fleet of tiny little garbage trucks that are golf cart size that go down every person's driveway and pick up the garbage in the back and bring it to the garbage truck in the front. You know, so that level of care of making sure that, you know, your house always appears sort of picture perfect from the outside, I feel like is one of the very unusual things about Shaker Heights. And I learned, I knew some of them when I was living there, and then I learned a lot more of them as I started to research the community that I didn't even realize were things we had to do.
So the part that I found the least easy to connect to other places that maybe I've known, when I think about just those, I feel like those rules and that history, perhaps I can imagine other places in the United States. But Shaker Heights also is foregrounding a desire for a sort of progressive vision around diversity. Around racial diversity. Is that right?
Yeah, that's been a really important part of the community since the 50s. In the 1950s, somebody planted a bomb at the house of a black lawyer who was living in Shaker Heights. And of course, in the 50s at that time, this was sort of the time around white flight started to happen. There were a lot of issues around segregation. And the community kind of came together and decided this was going to be a turning point and decided that they were going to actively integrate the community. And in researching the history of Shaker Heights, I learned a lot of stuff that I had no idea that they had even done, that for a long time they would offer subsidies, basically loans at really favorable terms to black families who were willing to move to majority white neighborhoods and to white families who are willing to move to majority black neighborhoods. So I was really interested in the way that sort of utopian goal that, you know, it's really laudable. We want to kind of actively promote racial integration and diversity. It's sort of accomplished through this very bureaucratic kind of rule fixated way. And that's really how a lot of things in Shaker Heights are, that they have these sort of idealistic goals and they're being accomplished through these, you know, kind of small, picky little pieces of legislation.
So you open Little Fires Everywhere with two epigraphs about Shaker Heights. So the first is an advertisement from the creators and developers of Shaker Village, which promises protection against depreciation and unwelcome change. And the second is a 1963 article from Cosmopolitan, and I'm just going to quote it. And this is what Cosmopolitan says in the 60s. All things considered, people from Shaker Heights are basically pretty much like people everywhere else in America. They may have three or four cars instead of one or two. They may have two televisions instead of one. And when a Shaker Heights girl gets married, she may have a reception for 800 with the Meyer Davis band flown from New York instead of a wedding reception for 100 with a local band. But these are all differences of degree rather than fundamental differences. We're friendly people and we have a wonderful time, said a woman at Shaker Heights Country Club recently, and she was right, for the inhabitants of Utopia do in fact appear to lead a rather happy life. So the way I felt this sense of defamiliarization around this place that you grew up in, that you're discovering the history of but was normal for you, is when I think of someone with an advertisement saying, will protect you against depreciation or unwelcome change, that's often looked at, especially in an upper middle class or upper class community that's planned, as code for keeping out people of color or of housing covenants that would not depreciate your values. But here we have this scenario where we see a lot of this code, but we're actually also seeing something that seems to trouble the code. And I was just curious if class and race stratified differently than it did elsewhere in America.
Yeah, so the first epigraph, which was from the Vince Waringen Company, the sort of founders of the town, where they're trying to convince people to move there around the turn of the century, they actually did start out with a lot of the 99-year covenants, where they say, you know, to promise that you're not going to change these things, all your neighbors have to approve who you sell your house to, which was, as you said, code for keeping out basically black people at the time. There was also some sort of animosity directed towards Jewish people in that area, but it seems like pretty early on there were a lot of Jews living in Shaker Heights, and it was really sort of coded towards people of color. And so it is really unusual that in the 50s the community really actively decided that they were going to kind of change that prevailing attitude, and that by 1963, when the second epigraph was written, that kind of almost planned diversity was part of the community and has been ever since. The second epigraph came about because Shaker Heights had been deemed the wealthiest community in the United States at that time. And Cosmopolitan, just before Helen Gurley Brown came in, was still sort of a general interest family magazine. And they did a profile of the community like they would do a profile of a person. I think there's also a profile of the Kennedys in this issue. So it was really like they were treating Shaker Heights as if it were a character, and kind of highlighted all the different ways in which they sort of were very actively embracing that idea that they were going to be the exemplars of this new way of living. That line at the beginning that basically Shaker Heights people are pretty much like everybody else, implicitly, except a little bit better. I think that's very much sort of how Shaker Heights maybe still views itself, and I think that's very much how it is viewed by other communities in the area, that they want to be kind of normal and everyday, but a little bit better, you know, just the example setters. And so I think that was what kind of led them to, in the 50s, decide, like, we're going to be the leaders of sort of, social and racial integration. That's a role that they've sort of taken on, of being like, we're going to be just like everyone else, but a little bit better.
The main family in Little Fires Everywhere is the Richardsons, and they are sort of exemplars of the ethos of the town. But I would love it if you could introduce us to the nonconformist family that moves to Shaker Heights and sort of disrupts business as usual, just by their very presence, not necessarily with any intention to do so.
Yeah, the Richardsons are sort of the living embodiment of Shaker Heights. They've been there for several generations. They're the kind of typical, American picket fence family where you have mother, father, four teenagers. And Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl, who come in from out of town and rent a house from the Richardsons, are really their opposites in a lot of ways. Mia is a single mother, first of all, so there's no father figure here. She doesn't talk about who Pearl's father is or where Pearl came from. They move around a lot, in contrast to the Richardsons having been there for generations. Mia and Pearl move frequently. They've lived in, 40-something towns in their lives, and they pick up and move whenever they feel like it. Mia doesn't have a lot of possessions. They move around basically with only what they can fit into their Volkswagen, so not very much. And they also don't fit people's ideas about what, you know, mothers and daughters are supposed to look like. Mia is an artist, so she doesn't have what we call a stable career. She's really not interested in material things or in any of that sort of stuff. She's really sort of focused on her artwork. She does a lot of work with photography. And just their presence, as you said, kind of unsettles the Richardson family and the community because they're so different. They're kind of breaking out of all of the kind of confines of what roles people are supposed to be playing in this community.
And notably, they're not planners.
They're really not.
They're not planners of the future.
Exactly. They kind of go by the seat of their pants. Mia will kind of decide, oh, we're going to move. It's, you know, I need new inspiration, or I'm tired of being here, or I feel like moving, and they go. And Shaker Heights is all about planning, and the Richardson family is all about planning. Mrs. Richardson is sort of very rule oriented. She gets kind of perturbed when things don't go the way that she wanted them to. And so far, for the most part, her life has been going according to the plan that she set out for herself.
Well, one of the things that Mia and Pearl coming into the community introduce is the issue of class also. And I think you handle the class dynamic really well. And I particularly like the scene where all the Richardson children, so the children from Shaker Heights, are spending the afternoon on the couch together watching Jerry Springer as sort of a theater of the spectacle of class. And this is one way in which it almost feels like by watching these poor people in all of their disgrace on TV, maybe that is one less charming way in which they feel like they're a little bit better than everybody else.
I think that's right. I mean, I have to admit that as a teenager in the 90s, I watched my fair share of Jerry Springer at, you know, friends' houses after school. It always seemed to be on. Whatever time you turned on the TV, it always seemed to be on. And, you know, I remember that we kind of enjoyed it the way that people, I think, maybe enjoy sort of, you know, like the pro wrestling that with a lot of theatrics and all of that. And in looking back on that now, I feel uncomfortable and a little bit ashamed about that because there is a big class difference there that, you know, part of the reason that we are able to enjoy these people acting, as we would have said, crazy is because there's the feeling that we will never be in that situation, that these people are somehow lower than us or lesser than us and that we're better. And that is, I think, something that the teenagers feel, even if they don't articulate it. Each of them has a different reason for kind of liking the show. One of them sort of looks at it as almost like an anthropological film where these, you know, these people are so different from her that she might as well be reading Margaret Mead. And somebody else looks at them almost as a psychological study. It's almost like he's studying depravity. And it's not malicious, but it's their unawareness of that class issue is one of the blind spots that they have.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to Celeste Ng about her second book, Little Fires Everywhere. So in your first book, Everything I Never Told You, which also takes place in Ohio, is about an interracial marriage. And in Little Fires Everywhere, one of the several points of tension is around an interracial adoption. When the Richardson kids are watching this spectacle of poverty with Jerry Springer, it makes them feel grateful to live in Shaker Heights. And part of that gratitude also comes from their sense that people don't see race here, that Shaker Heights is truly an utopia, and that this, at least in the mind of this white family, it is a post-racial community. If I hadn't read interviews that you had done prior to preparing, I would think you were doing a send-up of the hubris and self-regard of Shaker Heights, reading the book, with the Richardson family sort of emblematic of white naivete around racial relations in the city. But when I read your interviews, you often say that you experienced race in a largely positive way growing up, and that it wasn't only diverse, but that the community was engaged in race in a healthy way. So if that's true, I was just wanting you to talk more in this regard. Choosing to have the community and specifically the Richardson family claim not to see race and what you're troubling with around your own experience in the city.
Yeah, part of that has to do with the time period. You know, the book is set in the late 1990s, which is the time that I was a teenager there. I would have been the same age as the oldest Richardson child, Lexi. And the way that I remember sort of you showed your racial awareness at that time was to be, you know, quote unquote, race blind. That, you know, people really said things like, I don't see race. And what they meant was that race, you know, race isn't important to me, or I'm not, you know, this is my way of showing that I'm aware of this issue. And I think now we see why that's a problematic stance to have and why it's a problematic thing to say, which is that, you know, if you don't see a huge aspect of someone's life and experience, you are kind of devaluing all of the experiences that they've had walking around in that skin, you know, living as a person of color or living as, you know, somebody who's visibly different, and living in the context of a world that is discriminated based on race. And so part of the difference, I think, has to do with the time period, that it's been 20 years and we're still talking about these issues. But I like to think at least that we've moved beyond that phase of just blithe, innocent, you know, we don't see race here, we're so lucky. So even as people were saying, I don't see race, you know, and I feel like that was an attitude that I was also trying to cultivate at the time. I think that there was still obviously racism, you know, that we would hear certain things that we now might call microaggressions, but where we kind of bumped up against the reality of course you see race, because race is there. So of course you see it if you don't pretend to. And so a lot of that kind of disparity between sort of my experience there and then what we now see as them being sort of willfully naive, I think has to do with the perspective of time, that we've started to just see this issue in a more complicated way.
Yeah. Well, at least some of us. I know I see all the time people saying, I treat everybody the same. Anybody who comes into my life, I treat them the same. But you make this interesting point, and it's not specific to this book, but this idea around interracial marriage or interracial adoption, that it wasn't until the 60s that, or up until the 60s, interracial marriage was illegal in a lot of places. And it wasn't until the 90s that half of America approved of interracial marriage.
Yeah, that was a shocking statistic that I learned when I was writing my first novel. I think many people now have heard about Loving v. Virginia, which is the case that made interracial marriage legal throughout the United States, because there's been a movie about it and there's been a lot of talk about it recently, especially with its parallels towards same-sex marriage. But it was a real shocker to me that it wasn't until 1997 that a Gallup poll found that more than half of the people actually felt that that was okay. Mm-hmm. Because 1997 doesn't seem like that long ago. I mean, no. I remember 1997. I could drive a car in 1997, you know, and this book is set partly in 1997 and 1998. And so I do think that there, while I'm optimistic about the direction that we're heading in, it still is very clear that we have a long way to go. I mean, there are still people who, as you said, insist that they are colorblind, or that these things don't matter. I'm thinking in particular about the debates that have been going on in terms of casting in Hollywood. There's been a lot of discussion about doing what we call like race-bent adaptations, where if white characters are changed into people of color, there are a number of white people who get very angry about this. And likewise, those same people often don't understand the problem. What's wrong if you take someone who, you know, in the comic book was supposed to be a Tibetan man, and you change that character into Tilda Swinton, right? And to try to explain how those two things are not the same and that this is not an equal power dynamic, I'm like, okay, we still do have a lot of work ahead of us.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit further about the interracial adoption, which feels like it becomes one of the most potent areas of tension within the book. And there's a lot of, I mean, this is a perfect title, Little Fires Everywhere, because there's a lot of areas of tension in this book. But we have a well-off white family that adopts an Asian child whose original biological mother was living paycheck to paycheck. And the biological mother wants her child back. So we're set into a scenario where the town is dividing around this issue. You're on a podcast called The Mixed Experience, where you talked about among other things, about stereotypes you wanted to avoid in your first book. So the tiger mom stereotype for Asian mothers. And you talked about how Asian women tend to get exoticized or eroticized, whereas Asian men tend to get desexualized. I was curious if there were any stereotypes that you were particularly aware of that either you were wanting to avoid or wanting to employ as part of this tension that's happening in the town around mothering. and adoption.
Yeah, there are two sort of Asian mothers in the book. One of them is a minor character, and then one of them is the biological mother of this baby. The biological mother is a waitress. She's a recent immigrant. You know, her English is not that great. And the other one is the mother of, one of the teenager's friends. She's a doctor. She's high achieving. She's well-spoken. And I wanted to kind of make sure that I wasn't sort of skewing towards one or the other, this idea of the sort of like the noble peasant, like of the Pearl S. Buck mode of the like, she's very poor, but she's very good-hearted and she works very hard. You know, the biological mother, I hope, is a complicated figure. She is working very hard. She is living paycheck to paycheck. She does make some bad decisions, right? And I wanted to not play into the stereotype of the Asians as the model minority, which I think is so often a role that's pushed on Asians. But I also didn't want to play into the, oh, you're just an unskilled immigrant who came over and you don't know what you're doing. Like, I wanted her to seem like a real person. And that's sort of the line that I was trying to take.
Hmm. Well, you have this story that you wrote in Gulf Coast called How to Be Chinese, which to me feels like a really nice companion piece to this novel. It's about an ethnically Chinese person being adopted by a white family, but in that case, the point of view is the Chinese adoptee who has the American name Mackenzie Altman, which I think is great. But in it, she says about her mother, "She has taken you to a Chinese restaurant on your birthday every year. She has always bought you panda teddy bears, the Asian Barbie." And that reminded me a lot of the well-intentioned, perhaps, but not very well thought out or researched sort of cliched gestures of this white family who'd adopted this child. And I was hoping you would talk more about, you know, sort of good intentions and the limitations of good intentions in
Absolutely.
This regard.
So the story, How to Be Chinese, really had its roots in a website that a friend in grad school sent to me. We were in Ann Arbor. And I don't know how she found this website, but she stumbled across it and sent it to me. And it was a list of resources for adoptive parents of Chinese children in Washtenaw County, which is the county that Ann Arbor is in. And it listed a lot of different things, starting from sort of social resources and resources for learning Mandarin. And it's intended for parents who've adopted children from China. And then it moved along to haircuts. Here's a place that gives very good haircuts to small Asian people. And then it moved along to, here are some Chinese restaurants in the area. And here's Peaceable Kingdom, which is a wonderful store in Ann Arbor where they sell a lot of toys that come from China. And what struck me about it was the sort of two things simultaneously, the extreme good intentions and the real desire to try and give children something that, you know, we feel they need, that they get this connection to their birthright culture. And then also the complete inadequacy of the place that we're in, and maybe of the well-intentioned people that made this list, to do those things. You know, like, I don't know how I would begin to give someone access to a culture that was not my own. I have no idea. And I would probably come up with a list that sounds as cringeworthy as that. And yet their intention so clearly is to do what they can. And so that's where the story How to Be Chinese came from. I sort of started thinking about the things that a parent might do. And in that story, I really looked at the mother as being a sympathetic figure. Her daughter, the adoptee, I think is a little bit scornful of her mother until she goes out to try to learn how to be Chinese when she goes off to college, and finds also that she's sort of stymied in her access to this culture in all kinds of different ways. You know, she doesn't know how to play mahjong. She doesn't know, you know, all of the things that she's supposed to do. She doesn't understand feng shui. She dates this Chinese guy, and there's a huge culture clash between them. And so I think she comes around to sort of seeing her mother's intentions for what they are, which is that they are a gesture of love. And that was sort of where I wanted to go in this, in Little Fires Everywhere as well, that, as you said, we're talking about sort of the how far your intentions can take you, and at the same time recognizing that good intentions aren't always necessarily enough, that the adoptive parents or the would-be adoptive parents in the novel really do want to do well by this baby. They just maybe don't have the tools to give her what she needs. And so the question is, you know, what do you do about that? That's a question that I tried to pose of all the parents.
But is it too early to ask you what you're working on next?
I have a couple of ideas, and I'm sort of waiting for them to kind of coalesce. I've got two ideas that are kind of competing with each other. And so I'm in the really fun stage where I get to go down a lot of internet rabbit holes, and I get to do a lot of reading and research about really disparate topics that I think might work their way into one of these books. And I'm sort of seeing what kind of rises to the surface. So I can never get started until I sort of have an idea of the shape of the project, and I'm still in the process of kind of figuring out the shapes.
Are they both novels?
I think they are both novels, although I also have some short stories that I'm trying to finish up. I love the short story form, and I have a few that have been sitting and waiting patiently for me to finish them. And I'm hoping that maybe now that I've written the novel, I know enough to go back and finish the short story.
Yeah. And are they both in Ohio?
One of them has not taken a place yet. The other one, I think, probably will be set in Cambridge if it's set anywhere.
Oh, so we're moving.
So we might be moving, yes.
Well, it was great having you on the show today, Celeste.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
We were talking today to Celeste Ng about her second novel, Little Fires Everywhere. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as part of a new generation of Palestinian civil rights leaders. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I admit that in the past I've been a nasty. They weren't kidding when they called me, well, a witch. But you'll find that nowadays I've mended all my ways, repented, seen the light, and made a switch. True, yes.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined by one of the great American animators working today. She's brought characters to life in such films as The Little Mermaid, The Black Cauldron, How to Train Your Dragon, and Frozen. And she's been called the queen of animated villains. Kathy Zielinski, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So at Disney, you animated Ursula the Sea Witch in The Little Mermaid and Jafar in Aladdin, and you were the supervising animator for the character of Frollo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I don't think we need